Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you were with us for our last deep dive, we spent time in Volume 9, you know, immersed in the pure foundational science of hydrogen.
How it works, why it matters, the basics.
Exactly. Today, we are taking a massive leap. We are moving past the lab bench, past the theoretical math, and into the real tangible reality of implementation.
Right.
This is Volume 2, Scaling Up the Green Hydrogen Revolution. Our mission today is really to give you a shortcut to understanding the engineering, the money, and the global coordination that's required.
That's exactly right. We're zeroing in on that crucial transition from, let's say, laboratory innovation to industrial transformation.
Yeah.
It's no longer about if it can work.
No.
It's about how we build this colossal infrastructure.
Mm.
So we're digging into safety, digital systems, finance, and what the global deployment strategies actually look like.
And that outline really gets to the heart of what our sources say. Success here demands a systems thinking perspective.
Mm.
It's not just about improving electrolysis by 1%. It's also about human capital, international law, risk governance.
And the massive financial engineering.
Okay, let's unpack this. We should start with the most critical foundational element, safety.
We have to. It's the non-negotiable foundation. Most people know hydrogen is extremely flammable, but the specific hazards are, well, they're unique.
It's colorless, odorless, tasteless.
Makes leaks totally invisible. And while it's extremely light, I mean, 14 times lighter than air, so it dissipates fast outdoors, that very lightness makes it highly diffusive. It escapes containment much more easily than something like natural gas.
So the material itself is hard to contain, but then you try to store it for industrial use, and that introduces a whole new layer of danger.
High pressure storage.
Exactly. We're talking about immense pressures, often between 200 and 700 bar. That kind of pressure just magnifies the risk of any potential leak.
Precisely. And the danger isn't just the pressure itself, it's the material science of the storage vessel. You have to engineer around hydrogen embrittlement.
Can you explain that a little?
Sure. When you have high-pressure hydrogen interacting with high-strength steels, which you need for those tanks, the hydrogen can actually infiltrate the metal structure.
And weaken it from the inside out.
It leads to structural weaknesses, cracking over time. This dictates entirely new design standards for every single component.
And if you go the liquid hydrogen route for transport, you've got the terrifying risk of cryogenic hazards.
Indeed. Liquid hydrogen is stored at negative 253 degrees Celsius.
Unbelievable.
Any failure in insulation or handling results in extreme thermal risk. I mean, instant frostbite. Managing that is just far more complex than handling standard compressed gas.
Which makes robust, reliable detection technology an absolute must. How do you solve that fundamental colorless and odorless problem on an industrial scale?
It's all technology. Our sources detail the crucial role of sophisticated sensors. You have cost-effective ones like electrochemical sensors, which are great for general localized leak detection.
But for a massive industrial site,
you need more. For extremely high sensitivity and real-time feedback, you're looking at specialized laser-based sensors to monitor gas concentrations with incredible precision.
Now, when you look at the need for those sensors and the risk of embrittlement, it becomes obvious why standardization is essential.
It's not a luxury now.
I was genuinely surprised by the level of specific global codes that exist just for this.
And this is where the system professionalizes. Standards serve two masters, safety and quality. ISO 14687 is a perfect example of a quality standard.
It specifies the purity of the fuel itself.
Right. And that matters to you because sensitive components, like the catalysts inside a fuel cell, can be destroyed by even trace contaminants. This standard ensures the hydrogen you put in doesn't ruin your expensive equipment.
So it's protecting the tech. And for operational safety in the U.S.
That's where NFPA2 comes in. It's the National Fire Protection Association guideline, and it provides comprehensive rules for safe hydrogen use across its entire life cycle. Production, handling, storage, it's all in there.
Okay, let's transition now, because managing all that complexity and risk, it just gets harder when you scale up.
From a pilot project to a global system, yeah.
This is where the digital backbone of Industry 4.0 kicks in. Here's where it's really interesting.
The foundational tool here is the digital twin.
A living, virtual replica of a physical asset, like an electrolyzer plant.
Exactly. It integrates real-time data from IoT sensors and uses complex modeling to simulate the entire process. Operators can track KPIs, electrical consumption, hydrogen output, and optimize production instantly.
And critically, it's not just about efficiency. It's an indispensable safety component.
The ultimate simulation sandbox.
It allows engineers to run virtual drills, What happens if there's a small leak, a valve sticks, an overpressure situation?
You can test all of it. It allows staff to identify vulnerabilities in the design and practice emergency protocols in a controlled, virtual environment before a single drop of hydrogen is even produced.
Moving beyond the plant, digitalization is enabling transparency across the whole supply chain. This is where blockchain plays a really unexpected role.
It is unexpected, but it's vital. Blockchain gives you end-to-end traceability. The big challenge with green hydrogen is proving the energy used to make it was 100% renewable.
Right. You can't physically track a molecule.
But you can digitally trace the renewable electrons that made it. Blockchain lets a regulator trace a batch of hydrogen all the way back to the solar farm that powered its creation.
That eliminates ambiguity, which is the enemy of investor confidence. And you can automate the verification with smart contracts.
Right. They automatically check if the production met the sustainability criteria, the right timestamps, the right power source. It cuts down on administrative friction massively.
Digitalization makes the system transparent, but material science is what makes it affordable.
Yes. To get to cost parity with fossil fuels, we need cheaper, more efficient electrolyzers.
Walk us through the breakthroughs needed, because some of the acronyms here are pretty dense.
They are, but the principle is simple. Cost reduction. Conventional electrolyzers rely on expensive polymers, like the proprietary Nafion,
which uses rare earth minerals,
and complex manufacturing. The push now is for alternative membrane materials, like PBI and SPEEK.
And the benefit of these newer materials?
They promise to be cheaper and, crucially, offer enhanced thermal stability. That means the electrolyzer can run at higher temperatures, which improves electrical efficiency and drives down operational costs over the plant's lifetime.
We should also talk about solid oxide electrolyzers, or SOEs. They seem like a major efficiency jump, especially for heavy industry.
SOEs are fascinating. They're most efficient when you integrate them with a source of waste heat.
Like a steel mill or a cement factory.
Exactly. Instead of letting that high-grade heat just dissipate, you feed it directly into the SOE. That drastically reduces the electricity you need to create the hydrogen. It positions them as a critical decarbonization tool for heavy industry.
That's a phenomenal use case. But no matter how efficient the electrolyzer is, you still have to get the hydrogen from point A to point B.
And transporting low-density hydrogen is notoriously difficult. It's the Achilles heel of the system.
Which is why hydrogen carriers are such a huge focus. And the most promising solution seems to be liquid organic hydrogen carriers, or LOHCs.
Can you explain that concept?
Sure. Imagine a chemical sponge. LOHCs are organic liquids that chemically bind to the hydrogen. Once it's bound, the composite liquid can be handled, stored, and transported, just like gasoline or diesel.
Using existing infrastructure where possible.
Right. When it reaches its destination, you apply heat, and it releases the pure hydrogen for use. It's a game changer for long-distance transport.
It just solves the density problem, and that is crucial, because this whole revolution requires immense multi-billion-dollar upfront investment.
Which brings us to finance.
Yes. Capital expenditure, CapEx, planning is extremely sensitive here. Unlike a gas plant that generates quick returns, these projects have very long payback periods. Exactly. This requires specialized, patient, long-term finance. And this is where green bonds have become a key mechanism for raising that capital.
So how are green bonds different from just a regular corporate bond?
They are debt securities that are specifically earmarked and certified for environmental projects. This is key because it taps into the huge demand from ESG-focused investors.
People looking for environmental, social, and governance alignment.
By attracting that pool of investors, green bonds provide the long-term financing that aligns perfectly with the multi-decade nature of these huge hydrogen projects.
So that handles the big, stable infrastructure. But what about the high-risk breakthrough tech, the new catalysts or membrane materials we just discussed?
That's where venture capital, or VC, steps in. VC is essential for funding those early-stage, high-risk startups. But to attract broader institutional money, de-risking strategies are crucial.
What does de-risking look like in this context?
It means things like government loan guarantees, which reduce the downside for lenders, or public-private partnerships, where the government shares the initial infrastructure cost. These are essential to overcome investor reluctance.
It's hard to wrap your head around the global scale of these projects, but our sources give us great case studies. What's Europe's strategy?
Europe is heavily focused on what they call hydrogen valleys.
Integrated regional ecosystems.
Yes, linking production, storage, and utilization all within a specific geographic area. The North Sea Hydrogen Alliance is a perfect example, using offshore wind to create a robust, localized supply chain.
So, local optimization. Contrast that with the Asia-Pacific region, which seems focused on just pure scale.
The strategy there, especially in the Middle East and Australia, is centered on massive export-focused mega projects.
Like Saudi Arabia's Neom Green Hydrogen Project.
That project is aiming for a phenomenal 650 tons per day of green hydrogen, all powered by massive solar and wind installations.
650 tons per day.
It's designed to be one of the largest green hydrogen facilities in the world. And similarly, Australia's Asian Renewable Energy Hub is planning up to 26 gigawatts of capacity, almost all aimed at exporting to East Asia. These are utility-scale, world-changing projects.
Despite all this momentum, we have to talk about the hurdles. What are the key barriers that still need to be cleared?
You can break them down into three major categories. First, the economic barriers.
Cost parity.
Put simply, green hydrogen has to get cheaper. Right now, it's significantly more expensive than gray, fossil-based hydrogen because of the high capex for electrolyzers and the massive energy input.
And once it's affordable, we run straight into the second problem, infrastructure gaps.
Yeah, the numbers are stark. Fewer than 1,000 hydrogen refueling stations exist globally, and only about 5,000 kilometers of dedicated hydrogen pipelines worldwide.
Compare that to millions of kilometers of natural gas pipelines.
Exactly. You see the scale of the problem. This transport gap is a massive bottleneck. It's the classic chicken and egg problem.
And the third major barrier is the frustrating challenge of regulatory uncertainty.
It's fragmented everywhere. If you're a company trying to sell green hydrogen from Australia to Germany, you face a huge problem. There's no universally accepted international standard for what green actually means.
Germany's definition might be different from Australia's.
And that cripples international trade and market transparency.
Finally, we can't forget the human element. Public perception. That historical stigma of the Hindenburg disaster, what we call the Hindenburg effect.
It absolutely persists, consciously or not. The industry needs to realize that being safe isn't enough. They have to proactively communicate about modern safety protocols to gain real public acceptance.
So if we put all of this together, the finance, the tech, the barriers, what's the timeline? This isn't an overnight shift.
Not at all. It's a long-term transition. The roadmap looks less like a sprint and more like building a new global railway over two decades.
So where are we now?
We just finished phase one from 2020 to 2025. That was foundation building policy, pilot projects. We're now entering phase two, which runs to 2030. That's accelerated deployment.
Where market formation happens and those hydrogen valleys become operational.
Right. And the ultimate goal is phase three, from 2030 to 2040, global integration. This is where we see true cross-sector use and robust inter-regional trade begins, creating a global hydrogen commodity market.
It's clear that building a hydrogen economy is this profound, multidisciplinary challenge. It unites engineering precision with economic foresight and policy vision. The green hydrogen revolution. It is no longer a vision. It's a movement in progress.
And this movement requires every stakeholder, governments, industry, finance, and you, the learner, to play a dedicated role. That's how we move the needle.
So here's a final thought for you to consider. Given the critical role of standardized metrics and transparency in certifying green hydrogen, how should the wheel balance the desperate need for global trade efficiency with the absolute imperative to prevent greenwashing? Something to think about as you watch this revolution unfold.